the first many sessions will be about building trust. You can't just go, right, trust me, babies. We're just going to do this. That's just awful. And they will be scared. So it's a contract, an unwritten contract that we sign with each other.
I'm Victoria Perreault.
And I'm Amanda Whiteley.
And this is Coaching Shakespeare.
Hi, listeners. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode on physicalizing the text. We have such a cool episode for you this week and an amazing guest who I met actually in college while I was working on a production of Women of Troy. You're going to be meeting the great Vanessa Mildenberg. And Vanessa is highly experienced in all things language, language in the body, movement, coaching, interdisciplinary art, you name it. She's an amazing woman, and I'm so excited to speak with her again after so long.
Yeah, I'm excited to meet her. And it's going to be fun to have two of your teachers on. So, you know, she and I are going to dish a little bit. All right, listen, no further ado. Let's just jump right in.
Thank you so much, Vanessa, for joining us for our episode on physicalizing the text today. I'm so happy to have you.
Thank you, Amanda. It's wonderful to see you again. Hello, Victoria. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
So before we jump into any of our meaty content for the day, I'd love to just hear a little bit about the work that you're currently doing in terms of coaching, in terms of directing, any career stuff, and maybe also a little bit of how we know each other.
How we know each other. So we met 6 years ago now? 6 years?
No.
Yeah, it's gotta be.
I feel like it was 4 years ago because it was my sophomore year. Yeah, 4 years. Four years ago.
Oh, thank God, time's not flying as much. So 4 years ago, then we were working on a production of Women of Troy, and you were also auditioning for RADA. And we did a lot of lovely work on different bits of Shakespeare. And one of the things that came up was this physicalization method that we're in part going to be talking about today. This was at Middlebury College. For about 10 or so years, I was a returning guest artist, and I would be there for a month or 3 months or 1.5 years. And at one point, it actually felt as if I was working there 50% of the time and here 50% of the time, which was really lovely. I tend to oscillate between directing and coaching. It's either me choosing a project or it's a project choosing me. And when I choose a project, I tend to choose something where the text is really meaty, but the way that I then end up staging that, finding the truth of that, finding the story of that is in a very multimedia, very physical environment. So it's a work I choose to do. And then and I choose to accept work that goes in all kinds of strange directions or things that are strange for me. So I've worked with a lot of circus artists over the last 2 to 3 years. And of course, circus is moving into the theatre space now. Circus is moving into becoming its own kind of performance art. And that's been incredibly exciting, working with them, trying to find narrative, finding a physical language that is more of a storytelling language rather than ta-da. And in some cases also using voice, and that, and how do you do that? How do you use your body as a big basically a big elastic band that is taut all the time? How do you then produce, you know, sound through that, which is incredibly exciting. And then I've worked quite closely with a couple of performance artists doing wonderfully challenging work where we film on location, use poetry, use original music, and we storytell together in a non-narrative, non-linear way. So that's where I'm at the moment.
If you could tell us a little bit about your journey of being a student to a practitioner.
So I'm a multinational, which I think is a big part of my story and a big part of who I am. I was born to a Dutch father and a Danish mother, and spent my childhood and my teenage years in Holland, in Denmark, in England, and grew up trilingual with all these language influences my whole life. And I started dancing quite early on, and had that, you know, dream, got that dream at some point. I think I was 13 or 14. I saw the light and I wanted to be a dancer. And I just wasn't good enough. You know, it happens, especially at that time, because at that time you couldn't do the splits, you couldn't be a dancer. I think today would be very different. Today there would totally be a market for someone who danced like I did, but I persevered until I was about 18, 19, and then focused on academia and went to university, studied English, considered going to medical school because that was an opportunity as well, and then took a theatre class. Mm. Like literally just took a theatre class. And for someone who loved music, who loved dance, who loved poetry, who loved literature, it just all came together. Everything. It was a huge revelation. And so I fell in love with theatre practically overnight. And when I came back from university, I started working in a theatre company, and then I applied to RADA and ended up doing my training in London at RADA. And as soon as they realized that I was a multilingual, they said, oh, but do you want to work here? Do you want to work there? What about? And I said, well, if nothing else, I'll start a theatre company. And that's indeed what I did. As soon as I finished drama school, I started a theatre company. And we did a lot of research and development, meaning we worked with young writers or just new writers, because sometimes they were not so young anymore, and helped them explore their craft and explore their new plays and created platforms for them to share their work. We'd always cast, you know, a mix of really experienced and not so experienced people. And as this was happening, somebody came up to me and in one of the shows I was in, because I was also acting, and said, the choreographer can't make it. She can't be released from her contract. She can't make it down on time. You dance, right? And I said, sure, yeah. And they said, well, could you just, you know, take over? Mm-hmm. So I choreographed that show. Somebody saw that. Said, oh, do you want to come choreograph my show? And I went, fine. And then somebody saw that. And the rest was history. And 2 years later, I'd movement director to choreograph 25 shows. And RADA came and knocked on my door and said, do you want to come work at RADA? Do you want? And it was actually the incredible Francine Watson-Coleman, who was the head of movement and dance and the first professor in period dance in the world, the woman's, the best teacher I've ever come across. And she trained me as her assistant and allowed me to discover what coaching is all about. When you act, I mean, acting is, you know, it's wonderful. The moment you start coaching, it's not about you. It's about the other person. It's that focus. It's finding out what is it? Is it the tension they're holding here? Are they too locked? Is it fear? Is it and reading all those physical, vocal, etc. clues, and then allowing your imagination to just find a way for them to see that light and take that next step is incredible. And that then very naturally took me into coaching.
That's interesting, Vanessa. Amanda knows that she'll remember that when she walked into junior acting, they had no idea what was going to happen. You just walked in and just anything could have happened. Within the 40 precious minutes, we would have cried and gotten in piles all over each other and all kinds of things. And the bravery of walking into an acting class and not having a sense of what might go down is so profound. And it's interesting thinking about the dangers and the anxieties of working physically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me explain something around my sort of experiential journey that I prefer to take people on. The first many sessions will be about building trust. And that means that I need to build an atmosphere of absolute trust within whatever space we find ourselves in. And the space that we create between us. And that trust is gained through little tiny exercises where they realize that if they follow me, they'll discover something. So for instance, another quite specific example was actually the show that where Amanda and I worked together for the first time. And it was in a university setting. So there were a lot of hormones, a lot of scared people, a lot of brave people, a lot of enthusiasm, and really, really difficult text and really, really big, bold, incredible topics that we were dealing with. So we spent the first 4 weeks layering, and we researched and we discussed the history, the context. We discussed the language, the poetry in small groups or one-on-one. We would work in detail, but actually, we did lots of big layers, and we would spend hours on physical work, on physical trust work, on breath work, on moving on breath, on moving on breath and finding some sound, moving on breath, finding some sound and finding the other person, moving on breath, finding some sound, finding the other person, maybe allowing touch to happen, moving on breath, finding the sound, finding each other, touching each other, taking some weight, letting that weight respond, let go. I mean, and just layer upon layer upon layer upon layer until there was a sense that this whole, the chorus specifically, but all the women were breathing together. They started to get connected. They were finding their voices in a really deep way, and they were hearing each other. And they were really hearing each other, and they were really feeling each other. And with the men, we did lots of blokey exercises, you know, we did similar stuff, but also they were all soldiers. All the men are soldiers in this play. All the men. That's really extreme. And none of these men had ever, you know, some of them had shot a gun because, you know, it was America. But you know, they didn't have that. So for them to find a worldly wise and brutal side to them took also 4 weeks. And then we put them together in a room. That was the first time people got scared. And there was no reason for them to be scared. But they got scared because they came in as
two groups. I remember that rehearsal too, of us trying to break free. I remember specifically that rehearsal of us being this swarm, this mob in the middle, and the men holding us in. It was just an extremely emotional day for everyone. And I didn't get to do as much chorus work as so many of the other people, but I remember being in the thick of it for that. And everyone left just like.
Can you describe what went down in that rehearsal and what, I know exactly what you mean. So just explain that.
So I believe we started with a physical improv with all of the girls in the chorus, and we were moving, and it was this exercise that you taught us that I've used with so many of my actors afterward, where the eyes are closed, but at all points, one bit of your limb is touching someone else's limb. There's one point of contact at all times, and you're moving and exploring. And usually I've done that as like a partner improv, but we were doing it as a whole mob. So you were in this mob, and at no point was your arm not in contact with somebody else. And so these women were moving, and this whole group was kind of breathing together. And then the men were brought in on the outside to contain that mob, which is very much it was like a microcosm of what happens in that show as well. It's like there's this well of just female rage and emotion and grief and everything. And the male soldiers are here to just put bookends onto this heated, crazy mob mentality that's going on. And I remember there being a point where you told us, okay, get out, and get out, like, don't let them contain you. And I was just throwing myself against the other characters in there. And it was, you felt incredibly trapped, because I genuinely, and at no point did I feel like I was going to be hurt, but you really felt like you were facing an actual threat that we hadn't felt before when we were in rehearsals.
Yeah. And what the men did, all the men did, was they literally just created a ring. But they created that perfectly strong ring, that you know, barrier. So they were strong. Yeah. And we had some very little women who were literally hanging off the arms of the men, trying to crawl out. And then we'd stop it and we'd pull it back in, and then we'd do it again. And then we'd stop it and then we'd pull it back in and then we'd do it again. And it ended up, what everybody then discovered was we were actually staging the opening scene. And the 4 weeks had been, we'd done 4 weeks of work to get to a place where that was possible, where both sides could own who they were and felt a togetherness. Because
and
if
a
we
fight
tried
for
that,
your life as well. Because what I remember, and it maybe was just true for Cassandra, my character, but like there was a point in which I was like, I can't stay in the mob anymore. It was like a fight. It was a fight for like my life individually. And I was just like crawling between their feet, because Cassandra does very much, she doesn't leave the mob, but she does make that cut and run. She's out to save herself.
And I think that was so beautiful, watching everyone. Some were straight up chorus members, but every chorus member, of course, had an identity. They had a backstory, they had a family. So they brought their own persona into this. And so everybody had their own individual reaction to it, but they were aware that they were having that together. And they took that with them throughout the entire show. Mm. And at that point, I could start building the show, because everybody knew who they were physically. And as a director, you discover so much, right? Because you see people grow. And I mean, let's be honest, you have it all planned out and then it all changes because your actors come in and they go, whoop, what about this? And what about that? And suddenly you realize a particular quality or a sound or somebody can sing or, you know, and bring that back in, and it grows and it grows and it grows and it changes, it morphs. And that was very much happening on that day for everyone. It was very moving. Very, very moving. When you physicalize text, that becomes alien to a lot of people. A lot of people who are new to acting, new to classical text, especially, because it's good for all texts, but it really works with classical text. And the method that Amanda has been referring to was built during a period of about 5 years where I was experimenting, doing research with dancers, actors, voice people, poets, but very much focused on specifically dancers and actors, because, you know, actors come to dancing this way and dancers come to text this way, and sometimes they meet in the middle. And it's the alien, it's the thing that's alien that unites them. The fact that speaking fully embodied for a is alien to most dancers, especially in the middle of dancing. Dancing or physicalizing a lot on stage or in the rehearsal room sometimes for a lot of actors is bizarro. I've spoken to people who said, well, the moment you ask me to do something physical, I feel alienated from my body. And what happens is the voice changes, because the moment you feel alienated from your body, well, then your voice, you know, then you start protecting yourself from here and downwards, and your voice doesn't drop and there's no meat behind it, etc. And of course, that is what we hear in a lot of dancers, that it never drops down, because there's a, you know, not only the taut belly, but there's a whole protection system going on in dancers that just doesn't allow you to go down there. So when you physicalize a text, again, it's layering. And there's a thousand ways to go into physicalization of text, and all of them are wonderful to explore, and all of them have merit. But if you want to build something that really stays with you, then you start with the smallest bits. And what I found was, as crazy as it sounds, is you start with, well, of course you start with breath. Everything starts with breath and opening the armpits and stretching your lips and all that prep work. But once that's done, you start with letters. And I tend to start with consonants in this work. If I was doing voice work, I would start with vowels. But for this, I would start with consonants. And
give us an example of that. What does that sound like, Vanessa?
So here's the thing. It doesn't sound like anything. You taste, you feel, you sense the, you know, the sound. And then you allow yourself to sense, well, where is this coming from in me? Where is this sound born? And what trajectory does it have through me and out of me, beyond me? So a p is very different from an O. An O comes from a very different place, and it's got a very different shape. And if you start small, then you kind of sense where that pulse might be and where it might move you, and you just let the sound move you. P, p, O. Oh, and you allow it to grow. You see where it goes, and you allow it maybe to go to the extent of your fingertips if it is big enough. And then you discover where does the come from? Where is it? Is it from the spine? I mean, for me, it comes from my coccyx, and it snakes itself. It sort of shapes itself up, and that's how it feels. And so that's how it moves my body. But it is something completely different. It's got nothing to do with my spine. For me, actually, it sits in my toes, but it might be somewhere else for somebody else, in an eye. Yeah. So every single sound moves you. It's music. It's your own music. And then when you get to the R's, oh, it gets really interesting, you know, and you get to the B, when you discover where the B lives, you discover where the T's and the S and the where they live in the body, and you allow the sound to travel through your body as you move your body with it. You take time. You find every single O you could have. Find every single R or A or O. Find them all. And as you find them, you find a certain pattern, a certain way of moving that works for you. And everybody looks different. And most people feel similar, but everybody looks different. So it's not about what it looks like. It is that it's almost as if you're shaping. You know, if the O comes out and it shapes, or the O comes out and it shapes, or, you know, it's almost as if you're drawing with the extension of your body and the sound simultaneously. And then you go back, you take a breath, you have some water, and then you go and look at words. Mm. And it's not pedantic. It's like jazz, right? it starts to find its own connections. Nay is different from no. No, you know, the O comes all the way from the back. No is a really big word. Nay for nature. Nay is different. And it moves you in a different way. And it does something to your brain at the same time, right? It makes you think differently. You're not even aware of it. So you explore the text bit by bit, and you make it bigger gradually, and then you make it as big as it can be. You allow it layering up and layering up and layering, because the moment you go big, it needs to be right. Right? Because you've started something really truthful, really small, and if you grow that, it needs to be right. So you are completely present in this gigantic physicalization, and you could even do the whole speech with that sound at that point. And all the emotion, all the thoughts, everything is going through you. You are feeling it. You are being that thought, that expression, that whatever it is you're saying, you're being that with your body. And then you can pull it back and pull it back until visually there is a stillness, but the person who's speaking has all that movement happening inside their bodies, and it's keeping it all boom, 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 alive.
Wow. That was an amazing description. I wish, of course, our listeners could have seen how much movement happened during the couple of moments where you were describing that so brilliantly, and how alive your body was. It was shaping, your arms were moving, your back was moving, your chest was moving, you got bigger, you got smaller.
This brings me to something that's been a little bit of a new thought that actually came out of watching TV during the pandemic. So one of the few bright spots of the 2020 cable news was watching the American Sign Language interpreters standing behind U.S. mayors and governors as they're communicating all these updates about COVID to their communities. And I was struck over and over again by the total body work required by the ASL interpreter to communicate the exact same ideas, but there's this huge contrast. The mayors are stock still behind a podium, delivering absolutely shocking information, versus the ASL interpreter using her entire body to express the same ideas.
The mayor is often reporting news and dictating news, whereas the interpreter appears to be actually living through whatever news she's reporting, whether it's a hurricane, chills, vaccines, because you're seeing her body physically experience it. I was thinking recently about just the connection between emotion and motion, and how blatantly obvious it is, and we never really speak about how motion is implied in emotion. To emote is to move. And so it makes total sense that something like ASL that moves your body releases an emotional response from the doer and from the listener, introducing all of these other exercises, physical exercises, to increase my physical vocabulary, so that even if I'm playing a character who is really physically limited,
I have access to that full range of motion and emotion in the same way that if I have a greater verbal vocabulary, I'm not going to use it in every conversation I have. But knowing that that's there, knowing that I have access to that and I can pull it out whenever I need to is really valuable.
I want to play this quick excerpt. So this is a recent radio interview with Riz Ahmed on NPR's Fresh Air with Terry Gross. He spent 7 months learning American Sign Language to prepare for his role as a musician losing his hearing. He goes completely deaf in the film Sound of Metal. And in this segment, he says that using sign language is a much more emotional experience than actually speaking language, that the physicality required to communicate in sign gives way to a more emotional experience and connection. So let's listen to this little exchange.
I learned American Sign Language for the role over 7 months, and my sign instructor, Jeremy Stone, who's also a deaf advocate and a kind of leading light in the New York deaf community, really kind of welcomed me into his peer group and immersed me in deaf culture. And I realized that listening isn't something you just do with your ears. It's something you do with your whole body. You know, it's very much about being present, being sensitive, being open physically to the energy someone else is putting out there. And I guess through American Sign Language, I kind of felt like I was communicating more deeply and in a more connected way than I ever could have with words, because when you're communicating with sign language, you're communicating really viscerally with your whole body. And so as much as the experience of deaf culture taught me to value my auditory hearing, I feel like deaf culture, a world without hearing and without, you know, sometimes verbal communication, actually really taught me the true meaning of communication and listening.
It hits on it because he says he's emotionally triggered through sign language, which is what this exercise does. It emotionally triggers you. He says it allows you to inhabit what you were saying differently and deeper, which is exactly what this does. And I think
rather than hide behind it.
Mm-hmm. So this is one, as I kept saying, this is one embodiment mm-hmm. exercise. This is one physicalization exercise. It is particularly suitable to classical text, to poetic mm-hmm. text, to lyrical text. This is what it does. Mm-hmm. What he's talking about, that's exactly what it does. I'm delighted when I was reading these interviews with him saying it throws me out of my comfort zone. It throws me off balance. I have to surrender to the rhythm of the of what I'm saying. I mean, just exactly.
Surrender. Huge word.
Surrender. Surrender.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was just the perfect place to launch now into this next part.
Yes, in terms of physicalizing different speeches, one of the exercises that Vanessa taught me that I've always carried to my monologue work, in addition to the consonants and the vowels, is going word by word. And actually, I don't want to say dancing out the speech, but allowing each word to express itself on in through your body and allowing your body to move in reaction to that sound, in reaction to what's going on inside mm-hmm. of you. So Vanessa taught me the way of just going word by word through a speech. We started with Cassandra, but we've actually worked on Edmund together many years ago. And I just did the exercise on it again.
This is Edmund from King Lear.
King Lear, yes. So this is Act 1, Scene 2. It's right at the very beginning. We've seen Lear's interaction with his daughters. We've had that kind of plot established, but this is actually the first time we're meeting Edmund. And the first words that come out of his mouth are, "Thou nature art my goddess, to thy law my services are bound." So it's a banger of a way to introduce a character, because it's him not only laying out his past, his given circumstances, his condition, and that is the fact that he is a bastard, the younger son of his father, but also what he plans to do about it. It's a brilliant launch pad for his character's development for the rest of the play. But I went line by line through it to just see how these really bassy and root chakra-y words moved my body in the text, and it was so cool. If Vanessa, you could just talk a little bit about how you teach actors this exercise, how you apply it for yourself, and like what you discovered working with Edmund particularly.
So I do exactly what I just described. I literally walk them through the letters and the sounding and the sensing and the moving, and I let them do that with an entire speech, allow it to grow really enormous, and then shrink it right in so that it lives inside them. And the reason for that is, as you go on that journey, even if you do that really early on, there's an interesting discovery of connection between sound, speaking on the thought, and discovering what it is you are thinking, discovering what you want as you say it. And that's what's always so challenging with Shakespeare. And this exercise helps get you there in a really very direct way, because you stop analyzing for a while. You cease to think about the meaning. You don't need to be clever. You don't need to understand. You don't need to project. You don't need to, you don't even need to affect anyone. You know, you don't need to think about any of those things. All those things you've just bundled up, put on a shelf, and they're waiting for you to take down and click back in afterwards. You just focus on this. What I find most people discover is, A, they discover the power of the language. You discover why you're saying, and you were saying root chakra, and absolutely, when I was talking about I mean the right down. And if you do this exercise and various other exercises of this ilk, you discover that a sound originates somewhere in the body, and an R doesn't come from this quite the same space as an O, which doesn't come from the same place as a P, or a S that snaked itself up my spine, doesn't come from the same place as my B. And the B, which is what Amanda is referring to, sits very low in the body. It sits in the lower part of your abdomen. It's the pulling up of the buttocks. It is very basic in that sense. It sits in the base of the body and it bounces out from there, and bounces. And what that does when you walk through this particular speech is you move from lots of T's and F's and it's almost like little, you know, little daggers, little snags, little darts. And then you move into something that is much less controlled.
I think the major antithesis of this speech is the comparison of Edmund the Bastard to Edgar the Legitimate. And it's brilliant that the names are close, and yet bass just falls through the floor when you say it. And legitimate happens all in the teeth and the tongue. And so much of the speech is him describing just the fearsome, true nature of a bastard, and comparing that to the dull and baseless, honestly, status of a legitimate heir, how that isn't rooted in nature, and how that is so just a part of the plague of custom. It's something that's so drawn on rather than lived in and breathed in and sunk into. Like, it's two completely different characters, the bastard and legitimate in this monologue.
And he goes on a full journey from being very theatrical, really, thou nature art, my goddess. Ta-da! You know, he almost pops out of a box, doesn't he? Yeah, here I am, you know. And he's very sharp-witted. He's very clever with his words until it almost runs away with him, because it goes to brother. And then suddenly the sentences become these short little bounces of why bastard, wherefore base. And then he speaks for a bit, and then it runs away with him. Why brand they us with base, with baseness, bastardy, base, base. And the moment you start letting your body bounce that, you feel the emotions there. You don't need to do anything. You
it
know,
it just sounded like a train hearing you do that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so he gets into this of emotion and then pulls it right back and has a plan and ends up with Stand Up for Bastards, boom, at the end. So there's this incredible journey of discovery for him and for us hearing and seeing him and we're really discovering it with him together. And it's so emotional and it's really contained and it boom explodes out and then it's really contained again. Magical.
Talk about the emotional experience. How does it help unlock the emotion for the actor by exploring the text physically?
I think when you're going through a monologue and you're looking at it rationally, you're looking for the argument. And I think that's something that it's one of the first things that you always try to figure out when you're looking at a piece. Like, well, what am I actually saying? What's the meaning behind this? And what's the argument? What do I want as the character? But until I physicalized the text, I didn't feel the weightedness and the oppression that he's facing until I was hitting words like service and the blow of bastardy, base. And it just so happened that the way that I was expressing bastard and base was like this. I was just on the floor being hit again and again, like someone was just blowing me from behind. Very different than how he envisions his brother, which became something like legitimate, something that happens all in the face. I got a little preview into what it's like to think those things about yourself.
I want to press both of you on a thought. For example, I might be doing something in class and I'll say, okay, we're going to breathe from our thighs. We're going to breathe from our backs. And we would have just come off a unit where we looked at exactly how breathing works, how the rib cage works, how the trachea, epiglottis, all of this works biologically. And there are no lungs in your butt. There are no lungs in your thighs. But we teach actors to breathe from their thighs and their butts and their feet and all of that. So when you talked earlier about the idea of the coming from a certain part of the body, and we know that a ka comes from a whole different part of the body. But in fact, it is all produced in the mouth, in the different locations of the mouth. Okay, let's really talk about this. How is it that the b comes from a different part of the body and the ka comes from a different part of the body, even though we're making those sounds up here? Is the inside and the shape of the mouth the microcosm of how that sound is produced in the whole body? And what does that mean? How do you make a b from your butt? What does this mean, ladies?
So I just read a really cool book on chakras, and this is my watered down explanation of what chakras are. They're little centers of energy from the base of the spine mm-hmm. through to the crown of the head. And there are seven centers of energy. They're kind of compartments where we store emotion, and we can open them or we can close them. Mm-hmm. And each respond with different emotions. The roots is so much about your practicality, your groundedness, your ability to feel at home. Sacral is so much more about sensuality, creativity, and every chakra actually has a corresponding spot on the face. So the root chakra is actually connected to the lips. So it makes total sense if you go total sense.
Oh my God.
It's so cool. The sacral chakra is tongue and cheek. It's exactly what you just said, that different parts of the face where you would feel that sound coming when you go that does correspond with where we're talking about it sitting in your physical being, in your body.
Going back to your question about how do you speak about the functioning of the trachea one moment and then go into this. I tend to try and swap it around. Mm. Because for a lot of actors, knowing exactly where the musculature is doesn't help them at all. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of actors, it helps them a lot. So you can't have one or the other. You must have both. I tend to build sessions if it is within my control, and it may not be, and I'll come to that in a second. But if that's within my control, I tend to work on the experiential first and then look at the mechanics after, so that the imagination and the, you know, is free enough to have that experience, but so that the people who need the very real details get them as well. But I do find that kind of specificity early on deprives people of an experience, of a discovery, of a self-discovery, and ergo the empowerment that brings with it. If it's not within my control, because it may be, you know, I'd rather if I go in and work, I'll work from a physical perspective. I'll go and do physical performance, and somebody else will teach voice. It's separate. So in that space, you very early on in the training, it's made clear by everyone that we will be completely contradicting each other all the time. All the time. And that's because it's not either or, it is both. It's all three, it's all four, it's all 17, it's everything. Because what we're doing is we're giving everybody a set of tools, not just a set of tools that they can look at from the outside, but a set of tools that they really know, that they really feel strongly, in the way that Amanda is now using this exercise as a part of her toolkit. Now, not everything works for everyone. Mm-hmm. So as you go through your training, or you go through a rehearsal period, you take the bits that work for you, and you let everything else go. Mm-hmm. And that's why, also coming back to what we were talking about, some people get there, some people don't, because that method may work well for some people and not for others. And that is fine, because then we'll layer it on top with another one and another and another, because it isn't math. It isn't an exact science. It is constantly a discovery and a taking ownership and a making it real for yourself.
This has really been incredibly exciting. You have to come back and coach.
Yes.
I'd love to.
Yes, come back all the time.
I'd love to. I think it's amazing speaking to the two of you.
Amanda, I am so glad you brought Vanessa in. That was really, really a rich exchange. And it reminded me so much of something that happened the other day at school that I wanted to share with you.
So we did auditions for BCA for the incoming freshmen. And for the first time, we had to do it over Zoom. But it turned out to be great. So one of the things we asked these eighth graders to do was to do the monologue that they had prepared and performed with their mics off, so we couldn't hear the text. And they had to use their whole body. And of course, all 10, we had two sections of 10, all 10 kids are moving as they're doing their monologues, and they have to express the monologue knowing we can't hear a word they're saying. Mm. And they're huge. They're moving all over the place. They're stretching their arms. They're moving around the room. And this became such an interesting way, because once they actually did the monologue, then of course they're all just standing still. Nobody's moving. Once they have the ability to speak. But take that away.
Oh, wow.
And we could see, we could see the kids move. And we got so much more information. And of course, we got the emotional content, because I could see, they're outraged, they're upset, they're whatever, from watching these kids move with their mics turned off over Zoom.
That's so true. That when we have access to verbal communication, we get physically lazy. We just think that that's the primary mode of communication. That's really interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, I had studied under the great Josie Abadie, who was one of the most powerful female artistic directors in the country back in the 90s and the early aughts. And Josie passed away from breast cancer. But I worked with her. I assisted her for years. And she would say to me, I would look over in a tech and Josie's eyes would be closed. And I thought, the woman is exhausted. I mean, she's, you know, running Circle in the Square. She's running the Cleveland Playhouse. She's exhausted. She said, no. I'm listening. And then I'm going to watch and pretend I can't hear. And she would say, I have to be able to understand the show if I can't hear. I have to be able to understand the show if I can't see, right? It's an old directing kind of trick to do that. And all that storytelling has to be there for sure. Now, that doesn't mean the actors are now understanding that the audience can't hear. The actors don't understand that the audience can't see. Okay, that's different. But in this case with these young actors, they understood that we couldn't hear. And so they had to use every part of their body to try to communicate. It's a great teaching tool. It's a great way of approaching the work.
I love that. As I was talking before about physical vocabulary, I think that's the biggest goal of all of this work for me is just, again, and I feel like I keep coming back to this, of increasing those possibilities, increasing that range, that access to movement. So that no matter what gets thrown at you, you have just a greater arsenal of physical knowledge. One thing that has lived with me like through this episode is the idea of allowance and giving yourself time and space to explore things physically without looking for a product. In the same way that when you're learning a language, you're spending time getting those sounds in your mouth, like looking at a text that is just English with the same level of curiosity, with the same level of humility of, I don't know how this is going to be expressed. I don't know how to communicate this yet, but I'm going to allow it into my body and I'm going to allow it to move me however it does.
I like that. I like the comparison to learning a new language. Amanda, thank you so much for finding Vanessa. She's so exciting. She's agreed to come back and do a coaching for us. So she's going to do one on punctuation, which will be terrific. And it's been great.
Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to Coaching Shakespeare. I'm Marissa, the podcast producer and editor. Shout out to the amazing team who helped Victoria, Amanda, and me bring this podcast to life. Jeremy Schinder, our intern, Rachel Miller, and Nora Slonim, our graphic artists, and Nina Oso, our music composer. If you like the episode, we would love for you to rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're streaming. And better yet, tell your friends, classmates, teachers, or colleagues to check out the show. It goes a long way in helping us reach any future listeners. If you really like the episode, you can also subscribe to us on Patreon and get some great perks in exchange for a monthly donation. We also want you to reach out with any of your questions, corrections, or suggestions for the show. To provide that feedback or to inquire about masterclasses or online coaching sessions, visit coachingshakespeare.com and fill out our contact form. In the meantime, we'll exit pursued by a bear. In the meantime, we'll exit pursued by a bear.